John Handsome Johnny Roselli. His real name was Filippo Sacco. He was born in 1905 in Italy. And he was an influential mobster for the Chicago Outfit who helped the organization control Hollywood, the Las Vegas Strip. In the early 60s, Roselli was recruited by the CIA in a plot to assassinate Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Was he involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy? Some say he was. In a moment, Lee Server joins us with his incredible work, Handsome Johnny, The Life and Death of Johnny Roselli. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce our guest, Lee Server, graduate of NYU's film school. Lee is the critically acclaimed author of the international best-selling biographies Robert Mitchum, Baby I Don't Care, and Ava Gardner, Love is Nothing. His latest, as we're going to talk about tonight, Handsome Johnny, The Life Story of Johnny Roselli, the legendary mobster who was at the center of a century of the darkest secrets and untold story of organized crime, Hollywood, the JFK era scandal, so much international intrigue. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. Great to be with you.
There are books that I read and give out, and then there are show books that I read and I keep for myself, and this is one of them. I'm keeping it.
Thank you.
Nobody gets it as, and you did a great job on that Ava Gardner book too, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, Frank Sinatra was fascinated with her, wasn't he?
She was quite a dame.
This book, the Johnny Roselli book, was amazing because before we even scheduled you for the show, I had heard some stories about Roselli, and I'm going, man, was he involved in the JFK assassination? So we'll get involved with you and ask you some questions about that, but you start this book in a very intriguing way because Roselli, through all his contacts, and he knew Capone and all these people, they found him in a 55-gallon drum floating off the coast of Miami. What happened to the guy?
Yeah, I thought that might be a good starter for the book. I used the interview I did with the Miami police detective that was called in. Some kids had found a barrel floating. It smelled. It was had some kind of mysterious contents. And the detective had the barrel pulled up on shore. This is in 1976 in the summer. And they peeled the top off this big steel drum. And inside it was what the detective described to me as a bloated mass of, he wasn't quite sure what.
Oh, gosh.
That smelled awful. And with a little more digging, they found it was a body full of decomposed gases. And two of the limbs were sitting on top of this mass. It was squeezed into the barrel. And they took it down to the medical examiners, and they got this mess out of there. And this turned out to be a missing legendary gangster named Johnny Roselli.
Was it headless?
It was his limbs that were cut off. And as far as we can tell, it was simply for convenience. He wasn't, decapitated or tortured. They just had to hack him up to get him stuffed into this barrel.
What do you think happened to him? I mean, wasn't he the mobster's guy to go to? I mean, they shipped him off to Los Angeles to, watch their interests and get going in the movie industry. And he was integral in Vegas as well, unless he did something wrong.
Well, he did a lot of things wrong, unfortunately, and he had had a long, good run, and, the detective said to me, he had pissed off a lot of people, and it finally caught up with him. There's a lot of rumors swirl around, going from that the CIA killed him to keep him from spilling secrets, that various factions in the mob killed him. This remains an open case down in Florida, still unsolved. I have my own theories. I try to back them up with the context of what was happening to him. But his life had gone from a very high and powerful stretch to ending up in that barrel. And if some of the chains hadn't broken off, we still might not know what had happened to Johnny.
He was 71 years old when they found him in that barrel, to be sure. What made you decide, Lee, to do this incredible novel and book on him?
Well, this goes back like almost 20 years. I was working on something for a couple of guys in Los Angeles. It was an adaptation, a screen adaptation of an old pulp gangster book. And they were interested in seeing a screenplay out of this. And there was a large section of the book about this period in Los Angeles, off the coast of Los Angeles, off Santa Monica, when there were these gambling boats, these casino boats that they were running in spite of prohibition, and they went out past the city limits, and they had these full-scale casinos. Well, doing research, I found out that one of the owners of these boats was a man named Johnny Roselli, and one thing led to another. This research started to, turn up one thing after another. And I had heard of him, you know. I had heard about the suspicions, him giving testimony at the church hearings in the 70s and so forth. I just really had no idea how many incredible things he was connected to. And it took a while to get back to it and really to kind of know how to research a book like this and how to write it. So you could say 20 years later, here's the book and the result of that.
He moved to Los Angeles from Chicago. He was about, what, 19 years old when he did that?
Well, you know, he came from Italy as a little boy with his mother, and he grew up in Boston and in the immigrant Italian community there. And he his father died in the Spanish flu epidemic, 1918, and he was pretty much raised himself. And he began to get into some trouble. He began to hang out with the tough kids, with the gangsters, with these early bootleggers. And he had a flee Boston with another young criminal, and they just started wandering across the country. They hit various places. They got in and out of trouble. They did stop in Chicago just as it was starting to peak in its as the capital of crime during Prohibition. He eventually, just by happenstance, ended up in Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, he began to make his name. He joined one of the biggest bootlegging crews run by Tony Canaro, the king of the rum runners, they called him. And he became an ace bootlegger during Prohibition in the 20s. He was, by all accounts, fantastically alluring and charming figure, very smart, a strategic thinker, and one thing led to another. He was fast-tracked, as we'd say today, and ended up as a protege of Al Capone.
Jeez. Well, you're going to be a mobster. That's the guy you want to be a mobster for, I guess, huh?
Right. You couldn't get any bigger.
That's true. His name comes up everywhere when you talk about the Kennedy assassination, the CIA's plot to kill Fidel Castro, the illicit goings-on in Las Vegas at the time. Marilyn Monroe's name pops up. I mean, the guy seems like he was everywhere, Lee.
Yeah, just amazed me, was what a colorful character. I mean, you know, every day I dug something up that just it sounded made up. It sounded fictional. I mean, Johnny Roselli, Edgar Rice Burroughs was a friend of Johnny Roselli, the author of the Tarzan book.
That's right.
And he wrote Johnny into one of his Tarzan novels. They were neighbors and drinking buddies, and Burroughs, you know, loved him.
Did Sinatra know him?
He was longtime friends with Sinatra. They were good buddies. Johnny, you know, worshipped him. I hesitate to say like every gangster, but you know, he was the idol of many in that world, and they were pals. And Johnny, when in that whole golden age in '50s and early '60s Las Vegas, you know, Johnny could be found with one, two, or three beautiful women sitting ringside watching Frank,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and Frank occasionally stole one of his girlfriends, as a account in the book, when in the story told by to me by Jeannie Carman, who was a beautiful kind of a Jane Mansfield, Marilyn Monroe type, and used to work with Johnny as a golf cheat. They'd go out on the golf course. She was a ingenious trick shot golfer, and he would take her out and say, oh, you know, lay bets on with
you made money off it, huh?
Exactly, yeah.
Huh.
And one day he made the mistake of taking her backstage to meet Frank, and that was the last
that
time
was
he
it
saw her.
Frank yeah. fell for her. How did you even begin to research a guy named Johnny Roselli? I mean, where did you go? Who did you talk to?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this isn't like researching movie stars. Movie stars want you to know all about them.
Right, and
you know,
a lot of that's public. It's out there. You have PR people
right.
feeding you information and stuff.
And this guy didn't want people knowing his business, and tried for, you know, 50, 60 years to keep it hidden. Well, it was a very long adventure. I talked to people that knew him, that were still around, everyone from old girlfriends, entertainers, show business people, FBI agents, people from the casinos, one or two people with, let's say, shady backgrounds. And beyond that, you go and you go to the National Archives, you find the transcripts of the major trials he was involved in. You get the transcripts of the Kefauver hearing, which was an investigation into organized crime mm-hmm. in the early 50s. And there are these thousands of pages of transcripts. There's also thousands of pages of only recently released and previously totally classified and top secret papers from the CIA, from the FBI, secret reports, transcripts, and you know, it's just it adds up, and it takes forever. And you know, you get some of these FBI files, and you still find page after page redacted. You know, you these huge blocks of black ink where they don't want you even now to see what had been reported. But you go through them painstakingly, and you know, you take a paragraph here, you take a sentence there. Slowly, slowly, you start to put a narrative together, and you know, years later, if you're lucky, you have a book.
Well, you've got a great one here. Now, they called him Handsome Johnny. He was a good-looking guy, and everybody liked him whenever they met him, right?
Yeah, he was a figure of, you know, obviously incredible charm. And he had a, you know, a style about him. In fact, you know, many people said that what you saw in old gangster movies, you know, if you remember Humphrey Bogart and Alan Ladd and George Raft, the guys like that with the great suit and the great hat, and, you know, he was always immaculate, the grooming, the suntan, beautiful clothes, and he was a charmer. You know, he charmed women. He was a ladies' man. He was a man's man, too. And he was, you know, he could be tough as any other one he needed to be, but to those that he meant no harm, they thought he was just a wonderful character.
They loved having him around, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, their kids would call him Uncle Johnny, and, you know, it was he was beloved.
Were there any jealousies about him from the East Coast mob?
You know, Johnny, he was connected. He was a very unusual mobster. He was connected to first the Capone gang, which morphed into what we now call the Outfit in Chicago. And he worked closely with Jack Dragna, who was the godfather of Los Angeles. But he was also bigger than that. He was almost a kind of mob ambassador, and he was always meeting with all the top mob leaders.
From all over the country. Yeah.
Yeah. And, he put out fires. He was a strategic thinker. We'd help out where he was needed. He would go where he was needed when there was a problem. In a way, I used to think of him as the mob's James Bond. You know, he was this special agent that worked, wherever and whenever, and he was appreciated for that.
He gets involved in Las Vegas. He knew Meyer Lansky. He knew Luciano. He knew all these people. He got involved in Las Vegas. He was almost as if he was the mob's guy, right?
Yeah. In the mid-50s, and, his connection to Las Vegas goes back even years before we hear about Bugsy Siegel getting involved in the 40s. Back in the early 30s, it was Johnny that got recruited to go with another one of Capone's men from Chicago to go to Nevada and what we'd call a lobbyist now, though I think it was a little more nefarious. Well, I don't know, maybe that's a contradiction. Roamed around Nevada, basically getting the legislature to approve legal gambling in Las Vegas. The plan was to turn Las Vegas in the early 30s into what it became in the late 40s. Unfortunately, a lot of circumstances happened then, including Al Capone going off to Alcatraz, and the Depression hit.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was right there. And in the 50s, when Vegas, really blossomed and bloomed as this capital of gambling, largely due to the work of the mobs, Johnny was pegged by Sam Giancana, who was a new ruler of the Outfit, in the mid-50s, picked by Cardo and Paul Rico.
Out of Chicago, right?
Out of Chicago, the real forces, behind the scenes. But Giancana was the upfront, leader. And Giancana and Johnny hit it off. Giancana was, he was a special case, but Johnny could get along with anybody. And the two of them became the buddies. And Giancana... Johnny was at loose ends. He'd just gotten off parole, and he was looking for a change. His good pal Jack Dragna had died, and so it came to be that Johnny became a kind of ambassador or the Don of Las Vegas, and he held court at the Desert Inn out by the pool or in the coffee shop, and fielded calls from Chicago and from Detroit and from New York.
Everywhere. Hold on for a second, Lee. We're at the break. We'll come back and talk more. Handsome Johnny about the life of mobster Johnny Roselli. We'll get into his plan to murder Fidel Castro. And welcome back to Coast, Lee Server with us as we talk about his work. Handsome Johnny about the life of gangster Johnny Roselli. Fidel Castro took over, but prior to, Batista, of course, was very friendly to the mob with casinos in Havana. When Castro took over in 59, he shuts the casinos down and gets rid of the mob. At what point did the mob feel as if they needed to get rid of Castro?
Well, that's a complicated question because there is evidence of other not very successful plots, you know, that were simultaneously happening. Meyer Lansky may have been involved with one and some others. But the primary government-directed plot came directly out of the White House. when Castro took over, you know, if we remember the history, the U.S. thought at first they would be able to get away, get along with Castro.
Because it was starting, the plot was starting under the Eisenhower administration, wasn't it?
That's right. Eisenhower was totally furious with the idea that Castro was sitting there with this growingly anti-American government just off the shores of Florida. Richard Nixon became his point man, and Nixon went to the CIA. This was turned over to Alan Dulles and to Richard Bissell at the top, and Bissell entertained offers. The CIA was then, really in the middle of its craziest period. You know, they were capable of any kind of plot. You know,
they would just do it.
Control, and, just do it. So a guy named Sheffield Edwards, who was the security director, came up with this idea that why don't we ask? Because of course they didn't want to have their fingerprints on the assassination of Castro. So why don't we get the mob to do it? They hate Castro too, because as you say, George, Castro took away their all
casinos,
their casinos and their money, and so they thought about this idea, they decided to go for it, see if they couldn't pay the mob to get rid of Castro for them and take the blame, and Edwards and the operational support guy, Jim O'Connell, they went to their cutout guy, a man by the name of Robert Mayhew.
Wasn't he involved with Howard Hughes?
He was indeed. I mean, this comes full circle, and Johnny became involved with Robert Mayhew and Howard Hughes in the turnover of Las Vegas just a few years later.
That's right.
Very incestuous and complicated. But at this time, they turned to Mayhew, who had done a lot of black bag jobs for the CIA, and they said, listen, here's the plot. Go find us a gangster to kill Castro. And Mayhew knew a few gangsters. You know, he'd worked with all kinds of people in his assignments. And there was only one he considered remotely trustworthy, and that was Johnny. And he gave Johnny a call. He met at the Brown Derby in Hollywood. And, after lunch and a few drinks, he said, I have something to ask you. It's a mission, a request from the government. And Johnny, for all of his bad deeds, considered himself very patriotic, loved his country. You know, when a lot of gangsters went into hiding during the war, he actually joined the army. And so Mayhew explained it to him. Johnny couldn't believe it, but, you know, they began to discuss it.
But he liked the idea, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't like Castro either, and mainly he wanted Mayhew to assure him that this was really for the government, that it was the high-ups who were asking for this favor, and Mayhew offered him $150,000 of CIA money, and Johnny said, you're not going to pay me for this, I'm doing it because I owe this country.
Wow.
And, he never did take a dime, and that was the beginning of probably one of the craziest adventures in the history of the CIA.
In a bizarre relationship.
Absolutely. And it got more bizarre. I mean, Johnny, because there were certain rules and regulations, things you simply couldn't do without getting signed off by the boss, you know, and he had to tell this story, even though Mayhew wanted him not to tell anyone except whoever they used in the plot. But Johnny had to tell Sam Giancana, and to his great surprise, Sam Giancana said, "Well, I want in on this too," you know. So now they had a gang consisting of Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana, who was he was many things, and one of them was very unstable. He wasn't a guy you wanted to pick for a delicate secret mission, but there it was. And they gathered together, and they began to meet the CIA liaison, Johnny, Sam Giancana, and eventually the operation was moved to Florida, where the anti-Castro forces were in, you know, great number, the exiled community. And they began this crazy plot to find an assassin, to find a way of killing the CIA. When they decided the best way was to find someone who could poison him, the CIA went to work and in their, you know, weird science labs, and they came up with an all-new poison that could be given tastelessly and so forth, and no one could, Castro would never know he'd been poisoned. And until 2 or 3 days later, he got very sick and dropped
and
dead.
Died. Now, was this before the Bay of Pigs?
Well, the first part of this mission was before, and the idea was to kill him so that this, underground...
So the invasion would work, right?
The invasion, so there would be no Castro, and everything would be chaos, and they'd take over very easily.
Uh-huh.
But unfortunately,
okay,
everything went awry. Castro evaded all the attempts, and in some cases, probably the paid assassins just took the money and ran. And it became a comedy of errors, and this bunch, who now also includes Santo Trafficante, who was the head of mob in Florida.
God, and I hear all these names on JFK's assassination, Lee. We'll get into
Absolutely.
That tonight, too. Jeez.
And, you know, and so this group of this misfit band of assassins is sitting around hotel suites in Miami. They're going down to watch Frank Sinatra in the Copa Room and really not getting a lot of work done. And the whole thing became a debacle. And Johnny was furious. He really thought, you know, they had a serious mission here and a serious purpose, and these gangsters that he had unfortunately found himself in collaboration with were basically a bunch of
crackpots. Yeah, they botched the whole thing.
Yeah, and to quickly add, you know, the Bay of Pigs came, it was a disaster, and a Cuban Missile Crisis came, but Johnny, in Washington, they decided, you know, that this was a mess. They canceled what they had started, but still, they wanted, Bobby Kennedy and others high up still wanted to take a shot at this, and Johnny found himself, you know, in phase two of the assassination plan. This time he became linked up with a legendary CIA man named Bill Harvey, who was considered the James Bond of the CIA,
mm-hmm.
Although he looked less like James Bond, more like William Conrad in Canon.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And now Johnny and the CIA's top rogue agent became the leaders of a new plot to assassinate Castro.
They basically never gave up, did they, even though Castro outlived everybody?
That's right. You know, they formed down in Florida, where a lot of this resistance, subversive operation was happening. They were training snipers and training various rebels to be infiltrated, and Johnny himself took some of these Cuban rebel fighters across to Cuba from the Florida Keys, under the watch, you know, the armed patrols by Cuban Navy boats. And it was a wild, hairy thing. But meanwhile, the White House got into a standoff with Russia, and so that we, none of us blew each other, you know, off the planet.
Right.
They made a deal not to do any more, you know, shenanigans with Cuba, except that Bobby Kennedy was still interested, but that's another story.
Right.
But Bill Harvey went to war with Bobby Kennedy and basically got fired and told Johnny, you know, this ain't happening.
It's over.
Get out of here.
Now, Bobby continues, however, to go after the same mobsters who were part of the plot to kill Fidel Castro. He's going after them personally. He's getting Carlos Marcella dumped out of the country. They throw him in the woods somewhere in some other country. Trafficante can't stand him. I've always believed, Lee, that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was based on trying to get Bobby to back off the mob.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a theory with a lot of possibilities. There are so many strings, and, you know, the more you look at it, the more Marcello looks good for some part of this. But, you know, I think that those people who have tried to bring Roselli in on this, I went through so much, so many books, so many transcripts, and I tell you, the FBI had for nearly 2 years, while all of this is happening, had been trying to follow Johnny's every move. They had his house bugged, his phone. They had taps on his car. Well, watched him at airports.
Did they know he was part of the CIA's plot to kill Castro? The FBI.
That's a complicated one to answer because J. Edgar Hoover was going nuts. He was finding little bits and pieces about something going on between the CIA and the mob. The thing we have to remember is the timeline, the period. Hoover hated the CIA. You know, Hoover was the salt of the earth American. Mm-hmm. He thought the CIA were these college-educated, Ivy League Easterners. And he really, it was almost like the FBI was working for a different country than the CIA. So they never told each other anything. But Hoover was finding these little bits of maddening, intriguing details. You know, there's a whole long story about Giancana forcing Mayhew to bug the hotel room of comedian Dan Rowan because he thought he was seeing Giancana's mistress, and he's making them use CIA bugging devices, and that got busted by the police and led to a lot of this becoming known to the FBI. So it was a real, like, you know, a complicated cluster.
Sure. And then Giancana ends up getting it killed in his house.
Right. This was the beginning. The thing, so many things were going on at the same time. The FBI had finally under the watch of Bobby Kennedy, who also didn't get along with J. Edgar Hoover, but
he put up with him, I guess.
What's that?
He put up with him, I guess.
Yeah, just barely. And he had finally begun, against the law, to bug the whole casino operation in Las Vegas. So they were finding out stuff that nobody had known before about the mob's operation. But they couldn't use any of it because it wasn't allowable in court. So they were chasing down Giancana. They were going after the mob. You know, Hoover had had a big turnaround after the Appalachian fiasco in the 50s when he had avoided going after the mob and just pretended it didn't exist. Well, now he had turned around through embarrassment, and they were basically coming after them left and right, along with Bobby Kennedy and the Justice Department.
Yeah.
So everything was falling apart. Sam Giancana got himself into trouble. He lost control of his temper over and over again. And so the big boys who didn't want any spotlight, Joe Batters, Tony Accardo, Paul Ricca, these are the guys in the shadows that took, you know, were the bosses with a capital B, but they never went out and gave, had fights with the FBI.
No, they weren't like John Gotti. They didn't want that kind of publicity.
Right.
Did they?
And so Sam Giancana, simultaneously in the middle of all of this, was just seeing his career go down the tubes, and this eventually led to them getting rid of him.
Meanwhile, of course, JFK is having an affair with Giancana's girlfriend. It was a mess. We'll talk more about all of this, Lee. We'll put it together and take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.